Music and art, like storytelling, are distinctively human creations. Today's guest works in both media to tell stories, challenge assumptions, and explore our humanity. He's Joseph Butch Rovan, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me, my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. The show is built to explore the power of storytelling in any medium to shape public understanding. Our guest this week is Joseph Butch Rovan, who is the faculty director of the Brown Arts Initiative, an initiative to support cutting-edge artists. Butch, thank you for joining us. Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Yeah, Rovan.
Rovan,
yeah.
Okay. So, Butch, tell us a little bit about your background, because you don't, it's not the traditional route to the halls of the Academy.
No, not at all, really. I took a long time to get to Brown, in fact. I started as a rock musician after high school. I went to college for 1 year. I really didn't like it. I had trouble finding actual, I don't know, my path and what something that really matched my interests, and so I dropped out of school. I worked in electronics during the day. I worked in kind of research and design labs, building prototypes for engineers and things like that. Was a repair tech in the industry, but by night was playing a rock band. So I had a rock band in Los Angeles that became pretty popular. We were called the Jitters. And did that for about 10 years until I had the kind of classic of, you know, rock and roll story where the manager took all the money, the band broke up, you know, everything kind of imploded. And at that point, I thought, well, you know, I should go back to school. And I was actually accepted as a business major. And a week before classes started, I kind of wandered into the music department and I decided I'm going to change my major to music. And so that's kind of how I got back into academia and then eventually found my way to UC Berkeley, did my PhD in computer music, which we can talk about what that really means. Mm-hmm. Ended up in France for a couple of years at a big research institute, a government that supports the arts to an unbelievable degree. And stayed there for a couple of years and then finally started teaching in the States.
So when you were, I want to go back to your days as a rock and roller though. What kind of music? What were the Jitters like?
Well, it was the heyday of the new wave scene in Los Angeles. So it was really the perfect time and place to be, you know. And labels were very active in signing bands in LA at that time. It was really the hot spot, and you know, it was the days of padded shoulders, mm-hmm. you know, the whole new wave look. And we were a band that kind of focused on, I guess I would sort of say, like sort of thoughtful dance music. They were songs with probably, you know, more intense lyrics, but with a very kind of upbeat, kind of danceable kind
socially
of
relevant.
Yeah, I mean, they were, you know, and we were exploring different things and in ways maybe that some dance bands weren't really at the time. And we got pretty popular. We had a large following in Orange County, which is, you know, near LA. And we used to charter buses and brought busloads of fans up to our shows in LA. And it was a pretty cool scene. I learned a lot from doing that.
I'm living vicariously through you right now.
Yeah, did you cut any records?
Well, that's the thing, is we had a deal actually with that one. That's the part of the classic story, is that when we were at our sort of crux and everything was coming together, we had a production deal and money invested in us, and we're in the studio actually making the record, and that's when it all fell apart. So we never finished that record.
So we're all about storytelling, as you know, on the show, and we look at very different media. We look at film, we look at television, we look at art, we look obviously at text stories and the spoken story. Music is a different kind of storytelling. You don't have to be fluent or be able to read, quote unquote, a language. Do you consider music sort of the universal language in terms of storytelling?
Yeah, I think what's beautiful about music is it allows each of us to make our own story. You know, so it offers a kind of a framework for a story. I maybe it doesn't necessarily tell a story, but it helps us to tell a story, and I think that's what's beautiful about it, is that we listen and we create our story based on this sort of you know, concatenation of sounds that we're hearing, and we have different references, our own personal histories we bring to it. And I think that's the magical part of music, that we are sort of engaged in storytelling with the composer, whoever that might be.
So someone in Russia or China could hear music produced in the United States and on some level understand or relate or hear a story within that music, even if you didn't necessarily understand the lyrics?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, I guess that we should think about whether we're talking about music with lyrics and without. I mean, because even music without lyrics tells a story, and there's a long history of music trying to tell stories in pure sound. And, you know, there's lots of discussion about that in history of music and sort of tone poems and things like that. But when it comes to lyrics, I think actually you can get actually sort of the affect of a song, even if you maybe don't understand all the lyrics. Although I think a lot of times that's what drives us to want to learn that language. You know, when I was in France, you can learn a lot by learning some of the music. And I learned a lot from actually trying to understand the lyrics of songs.
So when you think about songs, when you think about music that has had big impact, is there anything that for you personally stands out as, wow, that was a song that moved the needle, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of them. I mean, there are certain moments, you know, going to certain concerts, you know, like a Bruce Springsteen concert in 1981 or whatever it was, and that was a moment I said, okay, I want to do that. Mm. You know, it's just one of those things that just kind of comes over you. But the songs themselves, I'm a real fan of bands like Death Cab for Cutie. I think there's some fantastic songwriting there. There's a band called The Weepies that actually one of the pair is a Brown grad. We're going to be bringing them to Brown to campus in the fall, and they're phenomenal songwriters. Some of their songs I think are the best that I've ever heard.
In terms of social change, music I think has been a force. Certainly, you know, when we look at America, in the late 60s and in the 70s and later periods, there were songs, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I sang this song for you on the telephone the other day.
Yeah,
I will spare our audience.
And he asked me if I would recognize it. I did. I actually did.
But the song was Ohio, written in the in the wake of the Kent State shootings. And that, I would argue, had a significant impact in terms of changing greater public policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Vietnam War was going on, that shooting was related to the war, the National Guard shot, you know, these innocent people and killed them.
Yeah.
Do you see music as having that role, not just simply in that case, but in other cases?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple aspects to it. I mean, there's the power of the music itself, and there's the power of the performers who maybe have a certain kind of platform from which they can, you know, express those things, and so I think that's the power of our popular culture, that it does, we have in a sense artistic leaders that have these opportunities to maybe sort of express feelings that all of us are having. And when that works well, it's incredible. You know, I think that's one of the things that music allows you to do, is to talk about difficult topics in ways that you can't really talk about. And I find that all the time. So you're teaching songwriting, for example, you know, at Brown, I taught the number of times topic of songwriting course, and you see students grappling with personal issues that they would never ever be able to say to anybody, and it comes out through their music. And so, I mean, I think that extending that to activism, that's one of the powers of music, is that you can say those things and they're out there, and it's somehow okay to say them that way.
I'm wondering if you've given any thought to where the impulse to music comes from.
The impulse to make music?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, historically, you know, archaeologists have found evidence of bone flutes made by Neanderthals. So, I mean, the idea of organizing sound in some way, you know, when do you call it music, maybe is a question, but the idea of making sound and organizing it in sort of discrete pitches that you would play in certain kinds of patterns, you know, that goes back a phenomenal length of time. And you know, that again, like the Neanderthals making flutes out of like bird bones and things like that. It is interesting that there are a lot of gestural connections to the way we make music, and this is something I'm interested in, is that the connection of human gesture to performance and sound making. And I remember when I was reading about the bone flutes that it really turns out that the holes are basically just positioned where you put your fingers. That's the pattern, you know. It wasn't carefully measured, it's just, okay, here's where my fingers go, and that's where the holes would go. And what's really amazing is that when they reconstructed that flute and actually played a replica of it, that pattern is something we call the pentatonic scale, which is a basic fundamental scale that's used by all folk music and even, you know, rock music for that matter. So that there's this gestural connection that sort of was part of the construction of the way we think of organizing sound.
Song has an unusual power to stay in memory and in your mind. It's almost like smell in some senses. Mm-hmm. You can be listening to a radio or go somewhere and hear a radio playing or on your playlist on Spotify or whatever and come across a song that you maybe haven't heard in 30 years, Ohio being an example recently for me. What is it about the power of a song that bores so deeply into the mind and stays there in the way, you know, certain images will do that.
Yeah.
But certain songs do that.
Well, you know, yeah.
That fascinates me, the whole psychology of why that would be. And I think that would relate to social change, too, if something has that profound an influence
well,
on you.
Well, yeah, that's really true, actually, that it can lodge in the collective memory.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, well, music is an amazing kind of memory device. You know, I mean, through the ages, song in chant, you know, from the Jewish tradition to the early Christian tradition through something called Gregorian chant. Mm-hmm. Chant was a way to memorize long texts. So you had intonation patterns, and you would actually have, there'd be particular recitation patterns that would go along with certain texts, and that would be a way that you would memorize them. I mean, of course, even Greeks before that, I mean, there's a long tradition of poetry actually being sung. And so melody is this way to kind of lodge text in your memory because it's a very different place. And I know Oliver Sacks talks about that beautifully in that book about music in the brain, and that there are certain memories that only can be dislodged through music. And I mean, it's a well-told story about people with aphasia that can only say certain things if they sing them. And actually, my father-in-law was an example of that. He had a stroke, and he could only say things if he started to sing them. Like, you know, if
wow.
He would sing, you know, my wife's name, or he'd say something like that, it would come out as a melody, and then he could actually say it. Mm. And so those places of memory are very different, where melody lodges versus a sort of normal text. And I know that's something that Oliver Sacks talks a lot about in that book.
So, you know, full disclosure, I am a frustrated musician because I'm not very good at any instrument, but I aspire to be still.
What are you aspiring to?
Well, I aspire to the piano mostly, but it's really aspirational. But my question is, can anybody create music?
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's sort of, there's such a range of, you know, what does it mean to make music? I think it's also what, you know, what do we want from that process? Is it that do you want to be able to perform in front of people and have people say, wow, that was amazing? Or do you want to sort of feel satisfied yourself that you actually were able to create something that expressed your own, you know, creative impulses? And I think like sort of the non-professional music making is really important. And that's why the sort of the democratic appeal of instruments like the guitar, things like that allow have a really kind of easy entry point. You know, you can get a guitar and about, you know, a month you can actually be playing about four chords and then you can play about 90% of any rock and roll song.
That's absolutely true.
I mean, so that's fantastic. You know, there are so many different layers to what it might mean to have expertise in music. And I think the main goal is to do something that allows you to express yourself.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can enjoy an audio version of this program four times every weekend on SiriusXM's popular Politics of the United States channel, the POTUS channel 124. Subscribers can download episodes at any time, too, on the SiriusXM app. Story in the Public Square is produced by a wonderfully talented crew at Rhode Island PBS. My name is Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. If you want, you can follow me on Twitter at JM Lutis. My co-host, G. Wayne Miller, is an accomplished and award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can reach him on Twitter at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest, Joseph Butch Rovan, is a composer, media artist, and performer who's also a professor at Brown University. He's on Twitter too, and you can follow him at BAI Brown U. So, Butch, you brought something with you today. You brought an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the endial.
Yeah.
Tell us what it is.
So the endial is an instrument that grew out of a lab that I have. I teach courses on musical instrument design at Brown, and that's something that's a huge interest in students and in general. We were talking about music making. I think one of the frontiers in music making now is new instruments that allow you to express yourself in completely new ways, you know, maybe beyond the guitar or keyboard. So Peter, in this class, had developed this idea for this instrument called the Endial. And it's an instrument that takes sounds, say, from your iTunes library, songs, I should say, and then it slices them up into samples or chunks, and then it assigns them to this really cool interface that's kind of based a little bit on the model of a circular LP. And then you have the ability to control the different slices of the sound, and every time you shake the box, which you'll see me do when I perform with it, that changes the whole sound palette. And so part of the deal with it is that it's, and this is something I worked with Peter on, is the sort of underlying technology part, where it has the ability to play with you in a sense, because it's algorithmically generating patterns based on what you're doing. So it becomes sort of a partner in accompanying you.
So with that as background, let's take a listen. So this is physical computing, right? Because mm-hmm. The way you move is affecting the performance of the machine. Right? Mm-hmm. So this is something that you have a broader interest in as well.
Yeah, that's something that it kind of goes back. If I can rewind back to when I first went back to school, and I was working in an office at UC Riverside, and it was actually the Office for Disabled Student Services, which was providing technological access for students who had disabilities of various sorts. We had reading machines, we had all sorts of gadgets, but the thing that struck me is that the gadgets themselves and the technology was really amazing, and it allowed people of many different abilities to access technology in different ways besides your typical keyboard or the mouse. And so I became really fascinated in this idea that there were alternative interfaces that you could engage with technology. And I went to a conference for technology for people with disabilities, and someone at the conference, just off the cuff, they said, well, you know, you could actually use this for making music as well. And I said, wow, you know, that was really interesting. And so I sort of took that little thread of an idea and kind of went with it, and that was the focus of my graduate education. And then when I went to France and was working in the institute there, I developed a body of work that's all based on sort of gesture as a kind of way of controlling or interacting with it.
So in addition to all of this, and all of this is a lot of this, you are now the faculty director of the Brown Arts Initiative. And that includes more than simply music. It includes arts of many different kinds. I want to read two quotes of yours and ask you to sort of expand on that. And this is about arts in general. And you said, quote, "The arts are the most important thing for humanity. It's the way we learn empathy. It's the way that we learn looking and seeing and hearing and listening." Pretty good statement there. Mm. And you went on to say, whether as an arts practitioner or someone who participates and enjoys arts, that would be just the layperson, I guess, that process teaches you something about yourself that you didn't know. Mm. It also teaches you a kind of creative problem solving. Mm. I don't think that I need to say that the world needs more creative problem solvers.
Yeah.
Well put.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Talk a little bit more about the function of arts in helping us solve problems, and we certainly are facing a lot of political, social, and cultural problems.
I know, and I have to say it's really ironic that we're sitting here today when the budget just came out that actually definitely show that the NEA is on the chopping block. Mm-hmm. So that's really, really frustrating. We think about the power of creative problem solving, exactly what we need. I mean, it's clear that there are problems that the solutions are multifaceted. They will be multifaceted, and that's actually what the creative arts allow people to do, discover other ways of thinking and working. I mean, as you kind of wrestle with your piano, you know, you're maybe discovering something about yourself. You know, you say, well, you know, if I try this, you know, and if you start to experiment, and if you sort of follow your inclinations, you actually will discover some threads of creativity that you really may not have realized you had. And those little kind of breakthroughs, they might be very small, but collectively they add up to a certain kind of creative confidence mm-hmm. that you start to have the sense like, okay, I can do that, I can solve that. I don't know how I'm gonna do it, but I can solve that. And that's what we need. We need people that have that kind of mindset. And that's what we're trying to do for the students, you know, on campus at Brown right now, but I'd say that obviously it goes way beyond Brown, is just to create, help to kind of nurture and create that kind of creative problem solver for the future.
Why do you think that it is such a hard sell, the funding on arts education in particular?
Yeah, well,
or for the arts more broadly?
Well, but probably at the basis of it, it's not what I just said about it being kind of a font of, you know, a way to develop creative problem solvers. Obviously, that's not a widely held belief, but because it's seen as something extra, you know, it's always the thing that's cut out.
First on the chopping block, even if you're just talking about public school budgets.
You know, it's really...
Always.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, sometimes I wonder if, you know, the arts, you know, arts versus sports, I mean, clearly the arts always get cut first. I mean, sometimes sports get cut as well. But I think it's just that people think of the arts in general. It's really hard to keep the definition from just kind of devolving into entertainment. Mm-hmm. So we think, oh, well, that's entertainment. And, you know, I don't need to watch that show. I don't need to go to that movie. Well, we don't need to actually do this in a school. It's all like the same kind of thing. And that's, we really have to be, I think that's one of the biggest thing is to really develop that definition in sort of the kind of division between entertainment and what it means to study and develop the arts.
You were in France. Other countries look at this very differently.
Yeah,
they look
for sure.
At the arts as a vital part of any civilized society, starting with their own.
Right.
Why are we different here? I mean, we have a whole range of opinion here, and I think the fact that the National Endowment for the Arts is on the chopping block and could be eliminated says something different about our country than France.
Yeah.
France hasn't proposed doing anything of the sort.
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure if it's the case, but maybe it's related to the sort of fundamental entrepreneurial pull yourself up by your bootstraps ethos that's embedded in what it means to be in this country. And so there's something about, well, you know, we don't need to help you do that because you should be doing that for yourself. And so that's the sort of a general, you know, ethos about the way that supporting something is seen as a negative in some way. I mean, and that's just part of it for sure. I mean, I'm not, maybe the arts for some reason don't have a loud enough voice, you know. I mean, I'm sure that the voice will get very loud after today in reading about the NEA. Mm. And there's going to be a lot of pushback on that. So we'll hope for the best
well,
there.
The late Senator Claiborne Pell, for whom our senator is named, was a great champion of the arts. In fact, he was one of the creators of the National Endowments, both for the arts and the humanities. And I can only imagine what he would be thinking today.
And I have to say that I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him, because I had a Pell Grant.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
well, he was a good man.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. Right.
So you mentioned the I think you said the democratization of music with instruments like guitar.
Yeah.
Right? So what about something 21st century like GarageBand?
Yeah, right? Exactly. That's fantastic, and that's actually where the end dial instrument is sort of targeted as well. It is, it's a device that, actually, as we've shown it to kids, they love it, and because it's very accessible. But it's also quite deep. And so one of the goals is to create instruments that have this entry point where you can actually, you know, like the guitar, you can pick it up and start to feel like you can do something with it, but you could spend your lifetime getting really good at it. And that's one of the challenges in the musical instrument design, is that creating something that has that kind of long trajectory of that would want to draw you in for that long.
And your background, you've been a professional musician, you're versed in the theory of music, but you're also a bit of an engineer, and an electronics engineer at that. So how accessible is the end dial to the typical, you know, high school student who's just interested in music for the first time?
Yeah, well, when we actually are working to license it and market it right now, so when it appears as an instrument, you know, on the shelf, and you would buy this, and we're hoping to have different tiers of it, so that there would be some that were very kind of low cost, more almost in a toy-like manner. So it would be something that you could probably even plug your phone into, and actually just it and your phone, and actually play music that way. So our goal is to make it really accessible. But again, there's this notion of virtuosity that always kind of is a thread through music in general. You know, as you're trying to work on your piano, you have this idea of, well, you really need to get very good, and at least you have a frame of reference. What does it mean to be good on the piano? We kind of know what that's like. A lot of these new musical instruments, it's not really clear what it means to be good on them, you know, because there's no history and track record. So the idea of virtuosity is a slightly ambiguous concept, but it's something that people are very interested in. Can we make new instruments that allow for virtuosic performance?
So what can people in your world, the world of education and also music, and in my world, the world of media, do to tell the story of the importance of the arts, all of the arts, for the public as public policy? That it isn't simply we're giving money away free to these people who do something I can't relate to, and why would I want to spend my tax dollars? That it's important for everyone.
Right.
What can be done to change that story? Because that story is clearly out there.
Well, I think, you know, really, you start, simply look around. You know, if we look here in Providence and see the impact of organizations like Community Music Works, City Arts, Newer Urban Arts, the Steel Yard, and on, you see the power of arts and the way they can change people and make a huge difference in their lives. So the thing to start with is simply acknowledging what's really happening, and we need to get that story out there and tell that story better. I know for us at the Brown Arts Initiative, one of our goals is to tell the story of the arts at Brown better, but that goes for the whole community here in Providence, that there are a lot of amazing things happening here, fundamental changes being made through the arts, and that story is just not well enough known. I think we have to work on that.
Butch Rovan, we're out of time, but this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being with us. If you want to know more about Storying the Public Square, please follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit us at pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on old episodes. Until next time, I'm Jim Lutis. He's Wayne Miller. We'll see you next week for another edition of Storying the Public Square.